Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's changing world. Your host is Dan Grunewald, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dan is joined by Archita Fritz. Archita is a commercial activation partner and board advisor based in Dusseldorf. She helps PE-backed companies build clear, repeatable go-to-market systems and is obsessed with the future of work at the intersection of AI, leadership, and sustainable high performance. Tune in to discover, first, performance can become protection. Archita reveals how overperforming to feel safe shapes many millennial leaders and how recognizing that pattern is essential to preventing burnout and building healthier team norms. Second, truth has to travel. Psychological safety isn't performative. Leaders must create the conditions, through trust, curiosity, and even play, for unfiltered reality to reach them before problems peak. And finally, clarity is the real accelerator. Whether introducing AI or pursuing rapid PE-backed growth, teams move faster and more sustainably when leaders align everyone around a simple, shared definition of what success looks like and why it matters. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dan Grunewald, and today I'm joined by Archita Fritz. And Archita is based in Dusseldorf, Germany, where I've actually spent a few nights out in the bars of the Altstadt. So we've been reminiscing. She's got so many cool titles, so many cool things that she's doing. So the host of the Embracing Only podcast, a keynote speaker, a board member, and I guess as a day job, a growth strategist supporting PE-backed and founder-led businesses. So where do we dive in, Archita? Like, how did you come to be doing all this awesome work?
Yes, I mean, thank you. First of all, I'm so glad to be here, and I love that little connection to your younger days. my younger days, like back, you said a couple of decades ago here in Dusseldorf. So that's amazing. So how did I come to do this work? So I'm an immigrant from India that moved to the US at 17. And I had only had one vision or one idea of what achievement looked like. And that was, you know, finishing college with good grades, getting a job, getting a visa that supported that job, helping me build my life in this country of dreams, that was the USA, and then, you know, growing and growing and growing somewhere close or at the corner office. That was my only vision, and retiring there. You know, that was all that was painted for me as that's what success looked like. And quite frankly, that's what I chased for 18 years, all the way from an electrical engineering intern in Kalamazoo, Michigan, to a quality specialist that was shipped over on a weekend to learn French and turn around a couple of manufacturing plants with the FDA coming along in Quebec, in Canada.
Wow.
And then, you know, starting kind of my marketing career, and all of this was in med device and med tech, 18 years. And then eventually coming across the pond to this side of the world and growing out our Europe, Middle East, and Africa business, from the ground up. And I always, in all of these spaces, I kept seeing myself as, and I'm not seeing, I was the youngest, the first, the only. And so when you end up being the first or the only, you end up becoming the person who tries to over-prepare to prove that you belong, right? And so that pressure to perform all the way from, like, you know, India, where, like, 10th grade exams were given with, like, not 100 students, but 1 million or 2 million people, right? So it's like pressure is just completely different. And so for me, performance became a sort of safety mechanism. Like, okay, if I perform, I am safe, ergo, I just keep overperforming, right? And then there were changes that happened. I stepped out of the 18 years in the one company I was in, and I was headhunted into private equity. And I went in very much with my eyes wide open. And I was like, this company, they were going to either go to IPO or they were, you know, I was going to retire before 40, or it would be the end of my, I would learn a lot. And so very quickly in 6 months, I learned a lot. And I did not, you know, of course, retire before I was 40. But that learning was very eye-opening as to why I didn't challenge myself sooner to try and do something different, because you keep saying that a promotion is you doing something different. But is that truly scary enough in your leadership journey to do something different? That's what brought me to my portfolio career, and then me finding different ways to use my talents to drive impact and serve people.
That's brilliant. I mean, there's so many questions I've already scribbled down that I want to dive into today. But before I do that, I'd also like to just learn a little bit more about the speaking and the podcast. Like, what is it that's giving you energy? What are you creating through that content?
Yeah. So, I mean, the podcast is called Embracing Only, and it talks about how do you use your onlyness as a superpower and not as a way in which we're like, we victimize ourselves, you know, like, oh crap, I'm the only person in the boardroom. Okay. I am the only person who looks like me, who has skills like me, talents like me, whatever, but how do I use it as an advantage to pull up more chairs, open doors, you know, pull down windows to bring other people at that table and change how decisions get made at that table, right? So we interview women, and we're focused on primarily women who are, you know, doing just that, who have been the first, the few, the only, and who are rewriting, you know, what it means to claim your onlyness and live in its brilliance, essentially. And so it is absolutely a passion project, and not one that, you know, as part of my portfolio, where like, oh, how can I grow? How can I? That's coming naturally, but it's truly something I deeply enjoy with my co-hosts, and we've been doing this since 2019.
Brilliant.
Through many changes, right? So yeah, that's kind of the premise of the Embracing Only podcast.
I'm going to have to tune in. Dial in. I'm still back 20 years ago when I was drinking in Dusseldorf. but it's fascinating. And you've said it a couple of times, like the youngest, the first, the only, just that language is very captivating. And I'm intrigued. I'm not sure why. I think I've always had a bias for like pioneering. And people that are pioneering, maybe it's got something to do with my family heritage, you know, landing in Australia and creating a life in Australia, who knows, but I'm feeling a personal energy around this, like your story about being youngest, first, only, the story of your guests and the power that they bring if they lean into the only. That's a fascinating statement, that they can actually be a change agent and a catalyst for bringing other people, other views, ideas to the table.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of the world, like a lot in every, and now we're seeing this even more amplified, that they're like, you know, kind of go behind and say like, oh gosh, they see me, right? That's what most of the world tells you, like, oh gosh, they see me. And our whole premise is like, yes, they see me, like see all of me, you know? And like, and I completely get there's so much nuance with this, okay? There's so much nuance with like intersectionality of privilege and everything, you know, being able to speak English, for instance, an incredible privilege, right? Like, so there's so much privilege from where I speak with regards to like this, this journey of like, oh yes, they see me, but there's still such an opportunity wherein I hear this every single time I'm on some kind of a conference or, you know, a panel discussion where individuals, you put in any kind of an intersection, right? Like, oh, women, it's harder for women to get on a board, or, oh, it's harder for older XYZ to kind of get into this. And I'm not disregarding like any of the isms, because they absolutely and 1000%, like we all would agree, they exist, you know? But the reality is that if you keep waiting for someone to recognize like, oh my God, she works so hard. Oh yeah, you know, and that, for that tap will never come. But especially when you are that first, the few, the only. So you have to go create your own opportunities or find allies, find sponsors, find people who can speak your name in rooms where you then can then create those opportunities for yourselves. You know? Because otherwise, I mean, we're all going to be just sitting at home and like wishing someday that we could do something in this world.
100%. No, I love that. I really love the way you framed that. And it takes me back to this other question I'd written down, which was the performance of safety you talk about. I've certainly suffered through that a little bit. I think a lot of people do. Pre-show, you said it's a particular condition or particularly pronounced condition for a lot of millennial leaders right now too. Can you just walk me through a little bit more about that moment, that kind of energy or weight?
Yeah, it's especially right now. You know, we were talking about it as to how we have a lot of leaders in the workforce who are either, you know, of course, there are lots of Gen Zs, baby boomers, but there's a significant amount of growing leadership in the ranks that are very much millennials. And millennials were rewarded through these kinds of statements. Oh, you know, I remember as an intern, as a first, my first job, a manager would send a message and be like, Archita, I so appreciate that you responded right away. Or like in a meeting, we'll be like, you know, guys, this is how you got to do it. Like, look at Archita, she's always on it. Or like, yeah. Archita, I sent you a voice note at 5 a.m. and you gave me feedback right away. I so appreciate it. So we'd listen to all of this and we'd be like, oh, this is good. I got to keep showing up, right? Like, I got to keep grinding. I got to show
the
long hours.
Dopamine hit.
Yeah, this dopamine hit is terrible. And so we just keep doing it. And that was the only way. Like, and so as leaders, then when we became leaders, this is something I've had to reckon with. And, you know, I think we got connected through Meeta Malik. And Meeta
we did, yeah.
Yeah, and Meeta just released a new book, right? So The Devil's Emails at Midnight. And it's highly recommend for everyone. Please go buy that book and buy her other book, which is Reimagine Inclusion as well. Yeah. But we had her on our podcast recently, and we were just talking about this whole idea of how, like, as a millennial leader, like, I was that devil. Because there were moments where I thought the only way to get, like, you know, to kind of reward my team was to congratulate them on speed. Yes. Like, their performance was tied to, like, how quickly they did something, how loudly they did something. And it was measured just on output a lot. Yeah. And it actually took COVID and a very, very, very introspective call with a chat with one of my teammates who called me out and was like, one of the girls reporting to me on my team, it's like, Archita, this is terrible. Like, what are you doing to us? Like, you're going to burn us out. And I was like, what? I thought I was inspiring, like, all this crap. But, you know, and then that is the reckoning we have got to have as, like, millennial leaders, is that first we've got to accept we are overwhelmed. We have to really, really accept that. Yep. Then we have to find community to be able to talk about it, because it's very lonely. It is so lonely as leaders, we know that. But we really need to, like, find peers who can also admit this and say leadership in chaos is just us pretending that we are calm. And then we're not going to model how to navigate uncertainty together, and our team is going to see it.
Yes, I love that. It's fascinating, the call out from the team member. I often see that that is an important role of team members and teams, is that, and I think Meeta's positioned her book very well with the stories of the bad bosses and what good leaders can learn from them. Because sometimes you need the team to hold that mirror up to you, because you're in this, like, zone, you know, whether it's anxiety fueled or cortisol fueled or whatever it is, you're like, and you think you're doing well, but actually, there's an impact, there's damage there to the team and to yourself, and you need that kind of brief moment of intervention.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we were also doing these things during COVID, which was, you know, these listening circles, right? So we'd, like, slow down, have a chat, and I would keep, and I think we had three conversations, and I had to pull aside one of my managers, and I was like, I'm doing something wrong, because the team is not, I'm not getting real information here. I'm just getting surface level, like, you know, oh yeah, Archita, like, this is okay. Or like, oh, I'll play the piano right now. Like, I just didn't feel like real, you know? And so as a leader, you too have to take moments to find your calm, like, in the midst of this chaos.
Yeah.
And when I spoke to him, he's like, you're absolutely right. Let me go investigate. And then,
interesting.
And not in, like, a, let me, like, you know, check on behalf of my manager, but truly Archita is like, you know, be honest with me, because, you know, there's a different level of psychological safety, right? And I recognize that. So I was like, I need to change that too. So I was like, and then I remember he went around, he gathered feedback, and he's like, this is not working well. This is not working well. And then I got on the call and I was like, y'all are all absolutely right. I was so blinded by, like, because I was in med device in peak COVID. our most important focus was ship hospital beds, because everybody is a huge under resource of hospital beds, right? So we were working 14, 16, 18 hour days. It was insane for like, I mean, 5-6 months straight, like not, you know, a few weeks. It was pretty intense. And so it was such an important like reckoning that in the most productive, in the most effective time, we cannot, especially in those times, we can't assume that we are being productive, we're being effective, because the team is, you know, functioning at their best. Sometimes the team is just trying to survive, to make it through. And so you have got to take that moment to really listen in and understand what are you missing and then what needs to change. Because it's not, then you're going to, you know, as my team said, member said, Achita, you're going to take, pull us down into burnout. And I was like, oh my God.
It's fascinating. We had a guest on the show the other week, and we were talking about there are certain events where you should know that the burnout or the overwhelm is going to build. One of them might be a market shift like COVID. Another one might be a big life event. You know, maybe one of your team members or your bosses has lost a parent or has a sick child or, you know, is going through some of their own challenges, had a fire at their house, whatever it might be. And that it's almost like as team members and as leaders, we should think of that as a dashboard and start saying, oh, this is upon us. We have to act in this way, but let's give each other a bit of grace and a bit of feedback on where it might be going wrong, you know, to catch it a little bit on the up rather than before you're peeking out in trouble.
100%, Dane. And it's like, you know, I think you probably heard this on your podcast quite a bit, but as leaders, how do we make it safe, I say, for truth to travel?
Yeah.
So the traveling bit is so critical, because if your team can bring that like unfiltered like reality quickly, you're always going to be ahead of that chaos. And then you're not operating from, quite frankly, all of us can write very nice fiction novels in our head about how amazing we are as leaders.
Yeah.
And that's where like your overwhelm will multiply and then their overwhelm will multiply. So that's kind of my... And it's not the fake like trust. Like I've seen that as well. That's really terrible. Like fake truth of like, every Friday I'm going to host Ask Me Anything hour, and you guys can come and talk to me about just about anything. Like, God, no, that's not.
No one wants it. No.
Nobody wants it. They'll dread it. They'll be like, I can already feel like what my team would have said if I had done that, right? So
we
would like stay away from the performative ways of getting the truth to travel to you, and just be a, you know, like a human curious about the people you are responsible for, because leadership is like a huge responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely. What was it about your colleague that allowed him to go in and get the truth from the team? Was it a particular approach, methodology, position?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. I've had lots of conversations with him about it since then, because kind of trying to understand just, you know, like just in the journey of leadership, like how do you find gems? And I think like, because you've got to have gems like that on your team that can multiply the trust in the team for the leader. Yeah. And I noticed that's what he was. He was like a trust multiplier, where it didn't feel like he was not seen as like the leader. He was not a leader's pet or anything, because nobody on the team felt that way. But he was a trust multiplier, is what I would say is the best way in which I understood it. And he knew how to have fun. Like I would literally be, and his name is, I'm going to call him Michael Arbuck, like thankful for him, okay? He's in Seattle. And he was just, and I told this to my team like from the beginning, like I had to look, I mean, I was not, you know, I didn't know what it was to have fun. Because I had 17 years of just overperformance, in India growing up before I even showed up in America, you know? And so to me, I had to learn this idea, and it sounds ridiculous, but quite frankly, like it was a very different culture. And so I would be joking, but half joking with the team. And I'm like, Michael, like, how do you create play in your life? You know, like really, like understanding that. And I think he did those two things really well with the team. And this, that being a trust multiplier and understanding how to incorporate play in like everyday interactions. So he made me that much better of a leader and challenged my discomfort with play.
That's fascinating. It's really interesting, because play, like, is it a way of lowering the stakes? I'm not sure, but it's fascinating that it was able to be a catalyst for that trust multiplication And even for you as a leader to come down and be ready to listen to what would have been tough feedback at the time.
Yes, because it just didn't feel threatening
yes.
at all.
Yeah, I like that.
It just felt like a way in which we could be the best that we could be for each other and the team and, you know, the customers that we're serving, but be the best for each other, because we didn't know, you know, at that time too, like we didn't know what the end was in sight. So we're just like, we can't keep going like this.
No.
Something has to change. And just because I shared this earlier, I'm very neurodivergent. And so I can have boundless amounts of energy if I need time of focus. And sometimes that can last years, right? Like it could be like 18 months of like, or 36 months of intense focus, which sounds ridiculous, but it's true.
Oh, I get it.
But the world around you is not that way.
No.
And so to have people who can like check your cortisol, as you said, and like check like your other levels, to be like, just because you spiked, you can't expect the team to spike at that same intensity.
Yes.
And you know, and it was tough feedback, but I think it's that mixture of like, and as a leader too, like how, you know, right in the beginning, because I brought him onto the team from another team and had to build trust, because he was reporting to one of the best leaders I have ever known in my life. Like honestly, phenomenal leader. They went on to become like, you know, do other amazing things. And then I was like, oh, I'd love to, you know, bring Michael over here. And I had to kind of build trust at the beginning stages. Like, hey, this is how you're, you know, you'll shine. And this is something that I'm probably a lot of folks here know, but I really believe in strengths coaching. So, you know, the Gallup method of like lead with your strengths. Like, so to me and my team, it was always like, how can I help my team lean into their strengths and not weaponize the strengths that don't come naturally to them, but we outsource the stuff that our team is not good at. And so we have so much cross-functional people. We don't have to be the best at everything, you know?
No.
So pull in the operations guy who's amazing in, say, project management to help us as we're getting this new product development, like whatever launch out, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of teams will like shy away from that because they want to showcase that, this department is doing just the best amount of work with all these people. But if you don't have the ability to like hire for that talent that is missing on your team, outsource it to other stakeholders within the company, which you have the luxury to do in larger companies, not so much in smaller. But
that's a good point. But even in smaller companies, you can bring a fractional resource in, or you can collaborate with a vendor.
Heck,
there are ways to do it.
Day. You're right. You're absolutely right. I'm like, that's really an important point. And a lot of folks totally miss that. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I was like,
okay.
You're just saying what I should be saying about think fractional, you know?
Yeah.
So that is so true, because it's such an easy way to bring in talent that can like just drop in and accelerate momentum a lot faster than a full-time talent would.
It also talks to some of the value of like us thinking outside of our intact teams. Like our research is starting to show that you can be on up to 12 different teams. Even though you have a singular job title and one boss, you might be on a project team here. You're getting pulled into a steering committee over here that is a team of sorts to do something. Then you might jump onto, you know, something to do with culture in the business or social activities for the business. That's a team. You might be building a not-for-profit fundraiser event. Who knows? Then you've got your teams at home, you know, church, sports, whatever it is. Like, you can be on a lot of different teams, and I think having that mentality to say, well, how am I showing up in each team, and who can I lean on? I love the strengths framework of like, if I have to come in really quickly and lean on someone, I want to lean on them for their strengths, because we don't have a lot of time to brief and tool up. We've just got to be like go time.
Yes, Dana, I'm so grateful you kind of shared the idea that our teams extend well beyond the brand if you're working in a company, you know, the brand that signs your paycheck or whatever it is. And then especially for me in my solopreneur journey right now, like I've had to lean on like accountability teams, on, you know, my like community that I before was not leaning on as much because I was in like, you know, this corporate utopia, and now leaning on them in a different way, which is like surprising. And so we really kind of have to recognize that for sure, that there are, and it kind of comes down to this though, ask for help.
Yes.
Like learn to ask for help.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is the crux probably for a lot of folks, is how do we learn to ask for help and do it often?
And it's also, I mean, it's funny, I share a lot of similar sentiments and reflections on the early part of my career. You sound like you were a one-person wrecking crew for a long time. You were just like going in there and get it done. And that performance as safety mentality, I certainly had a bit of that vibe too. I remember a mentor sitting with me once saying, you know, it's okay to use emojis. And I'm like, no, emojis are so informal. I can't use emojis at work. And yet she gave me this great piece of advice. She was like, okay, Dane, your job next week is to go and use one emoji at work. Because once you get the first one out and you realize you don't get punished for it, you might feel more comfortable. The same is true with asking for help. Hey, your job this week as a leader is go and ask a team member for help. Like, just one time show vulnerability and see how it feels. You don't have to fundamentally change your way of working, but we kind of need to create more awareness as leaders for like where we've got those blocks up in our approach to teamwork.
Gosh, yes, my God, when you said that about emojis, like I can't remember the number of times I've been like, oh, that's just not formal. That's just not weird. Like I've used those words, and I mean honestly, if you talk to my team, like, you know, there was huge shift. I would say, like, you know, it was like, I don't want to, like, you know, like literally huge shift in like how I approach things. But I think that's it right there, is that it's also cultures. You have to got to be like ways of business, and none of us are, you know, working in just one culture anymore, right? And so that's a big learning as well. Understand as leaders, what is formal, what is informal in different cultures. And so if you bring on a team member from another culture, really try to understand how is their leadership style evolved based on the culture they come from before you assume they understand the rules of that space, and then help them.
Yeah.
Because that's the other part. Like, don't then, you know, diss them or like be like, ah, oh, well, I brought her on the team, but it's just not the right, you know, this is where they throw it on this nonsense word, which I hate, culture fit. You know? Well, okay, friend, like, make the fit work for everybody, you know? Yeah. Expand it to fit for everyone. Don't fit them into something that is really not non-existent, quite frankly, because it's your worldview of how something needs to be done, right?
It's so passive aggressive culture fit.
And it's still used all the damn time. I actually saw this is the other pet peeve I have. Sorry if I get on a tangent, but LinkedIn Learning, and I was like trying to find somebody who knows someone to be like, this damn thing needs to be pulled down. This word around executive presence too. I have a huge problem with that, because executive presence has the same problem. It's rooted in so many beliefs of who held power structures back in the day.
100%. Yeah. We had that conversation at lunchtime yesterday.
And so I'm just like, you sit and do this on LinkedIn Learning today, 2025. Come on now. Like, and they're still talking about, like, you know, how you stand, how you dress, how you carry your voice, speak like this. And I'm just like, girl, shut the front door. Like somebody get this off of here. Because you can talk about presence. That's very different.
Yes.
You know, presence has power, 1,000%. But don't, you know, misconstrue that with this false sense of like what an executive needs to look, feel, talk, engage like.
Yeah. I love the way you just made it a singular word. Just make it presence. In the same way, I wonder if you can do the same with culture fit and just make it fit. And is fit actually more about how we work than who we are and how we behave because of our cultural backgrounds? It's more like, hey, this is how, these are the norms of the team. These are the way that we handle conflict. These are the way we run meetings. That's where you build your fit.
Yes. And I mean, based on these strengths that you have, here's how you help us, you know, elevate even further, because that team has to constantly evolve too, right? So for certain stages of whatever you're trying to achieve as a team, your team needs to kind of fit together a certain way. But then there's a different stage where it's like, okay, how do we evolve? So can we lean into more the strengths of specific team members even more so than we were before? Or do we need to bring in others to help us continue to evolve? So I understand this, like leaders are chasing something or the other right now. So they don't feel like they have the time. Like, you know, I'll put it in quotation marks, the time to make this.
Yeah.
But instead of these random, like 2-day offsite, you know, where you're just like, rah, 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 like something or the other. Like, think about how you can have a really, I'm trying to think of the like the word, I'm saying English word, but that's pretty much the only language I know in this vocabulary for this, but like a more, not present full, but I don't know what the right word is, but you know, being in presence, like conversation with your team, like yes. Creating a space where you can just have a conversation and not feel like your 2-day retreat or workshop has to have a specific outcome. Because yes. These conversations yes. will drive outcomes that you do not even imagine when you come back into the office. If you give it space to breathe, those conversations to breathe over that, you know, whatever you're doing, your 2-day offset.
It's fascinating. That's a great prompt, Archie. The conference I was at yesterday had an unconference session. So instead of it being an organized panel with a topic, it was like, hey, get together as a dozen people and just start a conversation with no objective or outcome and see what happens. And organically, we had some amazing conversations and people were asking questions and giving advice and giving support very organically. I wonder, to your point, do we need to be creating un-meetings in businesses mm-hmm. where you're like, hey, as a team, let's just get together. There is no agenda. There are no deliverables. We don't want immediate actions coming from this moment, whether we're going for a walk together or whether we're actually going out and sitting in a conference room with a blank sheet of paper and saying, hey, so what's on minds? I just wonder if there may be some power in kind of just stepping into that space.
1,000%. I love it. I love the prompt on unmeeting because it ties to like that performance and productivity, right? Because we tie like productivity to performance. We try all of this.
Yeah.
And so if we just unclick from like, you know, this idea of like we've constantly have to be productive at work, I am confident. I've not done any of the research on it, but just from my lived experience working with teams, yes. when we create those spaces, productivity just blows through the roof. Yeah. Because that's all, like, it's bizarre how little humans need, literally, how little correct. They need sometimes. To feel seen, to feel yep. heard, to feel like they matter in this big $1 billion whatever, or even $1,000 whatever that we're creating, yeah. right? And so I think we just need to tap into that and just make each other feel seen. And I like this idea of unmeetings.
Very the cool. unmeeting. You and I should work on it. We'll have an unmeeting
yes.
sometime.
Yeah, trademark. Nobody else say that.
I'll hold the show. I won't publish until we've filed the papers. That's funny. The work that you do with these PE-backed businesses, like let's actually just switch into that for a moment, because going back to performance and metrics, like private equity groups around the world are fairly well renowned for like flipping businesses. So there is a time yes. frame. We want our 3 or our 5-year exit. We've got to triple the size of the business. So how do you go about supporting a leader to create that moment of like mindfulness, clarity, space, for the team to really kind of re-energize and refocus?
Yeah, so that's a great question, because everybody's like, PE is the devil. Like, it's what everybody's telling me. And I'm like, sure, they're like, and everybody's somebody's devil, for yeah. sure, right? And sure, like a lot of, you know, the PE's kind of whole focus for the longest time was around financial engineering, right? How do you yep. financially engineer a P&L in order to get the best outcomes? And it still is to a great degree, but what we've noticed post-COVID with inflation and everything else, there's a huge emphasis on value creation.
Yes.
And so how do you create value? Sure, you create value through growth, through performance, but who's going to bring that? Talent. Talent, mm-hmm. talent, talent. So I think B is finally having a reckoning, and you can see a lot of investment around, like, you know, HR leaders and others who have had that background around building great teams, and they're yep. bringing people in who understand the value of like great talent. Because yes, PE has a thesis, right? That in 5 to 7 years, I want to multiply. That's just yeah. how, I call it the oxygen is urgency in PE, you know, like let's get this done and like let's yeah. kind of drive this through. But how do you do it in a way in which you are bringing in talent that understands the thesis? Because for the longest time, they would bring it, I think it still happens. I shouldn't say that. And I can't speak for all of PE, but I'm noticing in places that I work with, is like as you're building this growth kind of ambition and everything else, how do you bring in talent that can be really clear. So clarity is very important. So this is one of the things I talk about. You know, when we talk about mindfulness or space or whatever, you can create all of that with one simple thing, and that's just clarity. And in so many spaces, clarity is forgotten.
Yeah.
It is forgotten because it's like, of course they understood it. Why would they not? Like the board, the board meeting last quarter said that we need to do this. Of course, everyone's aligned. But that, of course, is going to literally cost you millions, and it's going to cost you talent, right?
Yeah.
So how can you be so clear as a leader? And, you know, we know this, repeat the same thing seven times, seven different ways. And so, you know, one of the PE firms I worked with recently, the portcos of a PE firm I worked with recently, the CHRO was like, Ashita, we brought you in to work on growth, but you're like transforming how we communicate, how we want to achieve that growth. And that is my mission, quite frankly. Because when you can get really clear on how you're trying to achieve growth, achieve whatever, fill in the blank, people will come along that journey or they'll step away and they're like, I don't want no part with it.
Correct.
When you're not clear as leaders, and I mean like we've re-engineered town halls, we've re-engineered team meetings, we've re-engineered L10s, you know, we've done all of that in the PE-backed environments. And honestly, I've been so grateful for the CEOs I've worked with, because that's the other thing too. The CEOs have to be open to the fact that something wasn't working right. That's why we needed to bring someone in. And now we as a leadership team are going to be open to what that change might look like, right? And work together on it. So when CEOs have not had that kind of mentality or like kind of direction, I usually have not worked with them at all. But because I'm just like, you know, you don't fix things that don't want to be fixed. It's just not a good use of my energy and cortisol levels, you know, to be spiked.
Yeah.
But that's kind of my kind of focus with PE and why I have chosen to leave a 20-year Fortune 500 med device like kind of focus to be like, this is a very interesting problem to kind of engage in right now.
It is
that creating value, how do we do it with more clarity and ensure that talent doesn't get burnt out through it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Like clarity is an overused word, because some people will say, to your point, of course it's clear. And I love that. That's just such a big like flashing warning sign. That if you're saying, of course, and to put that into context, I was just thinking about it. You know, let's say you're a leader and you think you were very clear last year, going back to your repeat it seven times and keep socializing it. You were really clear in February of 2024 about what you're doing in the business. Well, now it's late 2025 and AI has had a huge jolt on the world. We've had political change around the world. There's lots going on. And so the question is what we were clear about 18 months ago still relevant now, and how are we factoring in the changes? So I guess you do need to periodically keep coming back to that clarity. And I guess that leads me to a question for you, that as someone who's spent a lot of time in marketing, what is it that you bring from your marketing career that helps you really land not just the creation of clarity, but the continued kind of maintenance of clarity?
Yeah, I would say two things. I'm also an engineer, you know? So I think it's so it's like the mixture of both of them. So my engineering brain seeks clarity. Like it desperately seeks clarity of like making sense of chaos. Like I enjoy it. I like to solve for it, right? So that's just a natural way in which my mind goes. So my engineering brain like is going, understanding, getting curious. So that's me like doing the marketing work now, which is what I call voice of customer, right? So I'm talking to all my stakeholders, all my leaders around the table, the board members around the table, you know, what are the decisions we need to make in this room, right? What information is essential? Not like what deck we're going to present to the board to communicate this. No, that's garbage. Like that has to happen. Don't get me wrong. We have to do that. But what is that one decision we want to leave with? What is the one ask we want to have as we leave this room, right? So my engineering brain is like seeking like for clues in the chaos. And then my marketing brain is, you know, stepping into like voice of customer mode to kind of seek stakeholder like engagement to understand what we're solving for specifically. And I say like, you know, my marketing is focused on like product marketing. So I literally like to live in the center of like, okay, how do I bring sales, product, you know, marketing, customer success, all of them together in order for us to deliver the outcomes we seek, right? So then understanding what are the goals of all of these folks, right?
Yeah.
Because when you're building a new product, when you're making a new product, you're trying to understand what problem you're solving for the customer versus, hey, I have a product, now let me go sell it, right? Like that's the worst way you can go market for yourself. But it's the other, when you flip it like that and you're kind of solving for whatever the issue is that, you know, work, like our CRM system is broken. Well, okay, I hear you, it's broken. Okay, can I go talk to every single sales rep, not like as many of the account managers, talk to the BDRs, talk to some customers as well. So I do like VOS, like voice of sales, voice of customer. So you kind of bring customer stakeholder management. So those are the two pieces I would say. It's my, the marrying of my engineering mind with my like of curiosity and the enthusiasm to solve complex problems with the marketing mind of like, how do we put the customer at the center of it all? And in this case, whatever problem you're solving as a leadership team, somebody is the customer. Sometimes we are our own customers.
Yep.
How do we navigate that and understand our own needs as we solve for what we're seeking?
That's super cool framing. And it makes me think that we need to start training more people in those skills because, you know, as AI continues to come to bear, a lot of the confusion in teams is going to be around voice of sales, voice of customer, voice of employee. How do we make decisions? Like, you know, anyone who thinks that AI is going to take, you know, take what's not joyful out of work and make everything utopia is probably in for a shock.
I mean, there's so much. Oh, yeah. I mean, you need a whole other episode on like AI.
Yeah, we do.
The impact of AI and what is, because when we say AI too, it's such a generic term.
Yeah.
Like, Gen AI, is it LLM models? Like what aspect of AI are we debating on, right? So the reality is that, and in boardrooms today, we are having very generic conversations. We're still, and we're, you know, so we're having ESG imperatives in boardrooms. And at the same time, we're like, oh, we need to deploy AI. It directly conflicts with those ESG, but no one's, you know, and I should not say no one because I'm not in every boardroom, but we have an opportunity to have those healthier debates around this is, you know, this is what is going to be the new like Microsoft Word, the new typewriter, the new computer, new tool, right? The new car, for instance, that we have to like use, the Model T that we all have to kind of get into and like go. And it has its implications. How do we responsibly engage with those implications as an organization? But everyone's just looking for a shortcut right now, right? Because P operating partners will put on like an imperative, like every portco has to be using some form of AI.
There's a FOMO there.
Let me go. And then there's like this whole, another ensuing of chaos.
Yes.
But
yeah, no, I agree with you entirely. I think it's interesting the way you frame that though, that, you know, pursuing AI might be actually at the cost of your ESG strategy. And when we just run towards what we're afraid of, we're closing the time between the question and the answer, and we're often not thinking about the second order impact. So we, going back to the unmeeting and creating space and time, we kind of need to like pull question and answer apart and spend a bit more time in there as a team.
Said beautifully, Dane. Like that was so eloquently said. Thank you. That's on point. You're absolutely right. Yes.
Neat. Well, there's been so many great things. We are going to have to record a second episode another time. But so many great things we've covered. I loved just your honesty around like performance as safety and how we've operated with that mindset for a lot of leaders, which has led to, you know, some burnout, some overwhelm, and some unhealthy team practices. I love the conversation we had around the podcast and about your experience of being sort of one of the first, the few, the only, and the power that being in that position can create, particularly as a catalyst for, you know, bringing other people, other ideas, other perspectives to bear. And then as we move through the conversation, you know, that work of like finding your calm as a leader, getting the real conversation, the you called it getting truth to travel. I thought that was phenomenal. And I loved how you had your teammate Michael come in and bring some play and fun and lower the stakes to really make that truth travel. That was super cool. And then we're wrapping up here at the end talking about, you know, strength coaching and avoiding some of the structural language that we've used that causes problems in teams, you know, culture fit or executive presence. Like, let's lean into the strengths of people and be very intentional about our work. And naturally, this last little piece here on you know, how to engage with some of these teams and create the space to build clarity. Like, we've covered so much ground in 40-odd minutes. It's been a blast. If any of our listeners want to find your podcast, the Embracing Only podcast, or your material, your speaking, or just connect about any ideas, how do they find you?
So I have an unhealthy relationship that I have to go tell my therapist about with LinkedIn. So you're welcome to like find me on LinkedIn. That's where I'm at. So literally just DM me on LinkedIn, connect with me on LinkedIn. I'd love to chat. It's Archita Fritz, my name. You know, you'll find me. You can also look, have my website, architafritz.com. Or brilliant. You can always like, you know, tune into any of our episodes on any of Apple, Spotify, anywhere you listen to your podcast at Embracing Only.
I'll be doing that today on my drive home.
Yay, I love to hear that.
Thanks so much, Archita. This has been a blast, and I look forward to staying in touch.
Thank you so much for having me, Dean. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation, and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on the Future of Teamwork.